Good morning. You're listening to author, activist, and journalist Cory Doctorow and Too Much Scrolling. I'll see you in the future.
Welcome to Too Much Scrolling for April 26, 2022. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
Hey, it's the end of the month. Rent is due, and Pam is here to discuss some literary works. Hi, Pam. How are you?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
It's the end of the school year. It is paperwork time and fun time with books and reading. And the sun came out, and it was sunny and warm yesterday. How about that?
And Chip, I don't know if it's the end of the year for you, but an 18-hour novel for the very end of the semester when I'm trying to write reports and grade papers and write a final exam. Thanks, buddy.
Film at 11. To our film at 11, our movie of the week. Hey, Chip, did you make it to the movie theater this week?
I did make it to the movie theater this week, Steve.
And you're in Florida, and you went to a kind of famous movie theater, right?
I went to a fancy theater, Steve. I went to a fancy theater, and you're correct. I'm in Gainesville, Florida, right next to the University of Florida. And there's a Hippodrome there, which is they have live performances. They also have art. Movies. And so, you know, I went to the art theater, Steve.
And you saw the art movie of the week, right? This is the fancy, high brow film, Aha, the movie.
Yeah, about the band Aha, Steve. The band from Norway.
Yes, a Norwegian film. Did it have subtitles?
It did have subtitles, Steve. And I was in there with a college student and his girlfriend, and they were, he was going to use this to write a paper because he had to see a live performance. So this was actually a movie. It wasn't a live performance. The professor said it was okay.
So you were doing homework for this film, huh?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, this is about the band Aha. Aha is really considered one of the quintessential 80s bands. Many people may consider them a one-hit wonder. They're not quite that. They did have a few minor hits, and they did get the James Bond film. They did sing one of the songs for the James Bond film. This is a really very slow movie, and unless you're from Norway, maybe not the thing that you're looking for. I was looking for an 80s celebration with the song Take On Me, which is certainly light, poppy, and certainly a lot of fun. This was way, way, way too long. There was a lot of nice flourishes there based on... Have either one of you seen the video for Take On Me?
Well, yeah, that's what made that song. The only reason we know that song is because MTV and that video, that special video with the drawing that comes to life, Take On Me.
Well, I will argue against that. They tried to record the song two or three times. Really? And this song was designed to be a pop hit.
Hmm.
And there's a long story on this. In fact, there's an article I probably can find for you guys if you want to read about it. But this was a song that they felt there was something to it, that they would make it into a big hit. They released it maybe more than once. Hmm. Anyway, they kept reproducing it, and they finally got this song. Now, you're correct in the sense that the video was one of the reasons it got noticed, because it got in heavy rotation, but it was a little more than that. And, you know, as you can always imagine, just you want to try to hit those high notes, Steve. Hit those high notes in that song. Anyway, this is, the song is introduced early enough. They're poor, starving kids in London trying to make it as a band. They get back to Norway. They sing out, bring out the song. They tour the world. They're not happy with each other. They're still touring the world. And then the credits come by. I'll say this is a good, 40 out of 100 for a movie. And once again, I thought this would be a celebration of the 80s and sort of it would be light and poppy. Instead, we got, you know, into the deep levels of these the three members of this band, and sometimes they like each other and sometimes they don't.
So did it make for a good paper? How did your paper go? Did you get an A on it?
The student wrote the paper, Steve.
But would you have liked to write a paper about this movie?
Absolutely not. This is an awful, awful... the whole point is you're going to go in there and you're going to get like all the quirky things about the 80s. No, you didn't. You got a little bit of the song. You got a little of the quirkiness. That video, they used the drawings through it to transition in the movie. You're getting a lot of interviews with the band members. And the band members are nice. They all have careers, but it's just not that interesting.
Okay. I watched a very interesting TV show called The Outlaws, which is available on Amazon Prime right now. This is a very British, silly comedy that turns into a very, very serious drama. This is created by Stephen Merchant, who you know, he's that really tall British guy that's been in, well, everything, because there are 18 actors in Britain. But this is the story of seven strangers from different walks of life who are brought together to do community service, cleaning up a site in Bristol, England. And the stories of these seven characters are some of the most well-written character development pieces I've seen in a very, very long time. Each character has a backstory, and it's explored deeply in this seven-hour miniseries. The one that's going to get you, Chip, is Christopher Walken is a career criminal, and just Christopher Walken's all over this movie. Playing him against these young kids who don't quite have the same criminal background, and then Stephen Merchant as this really gawky, weird, standing there awkwardly bad, awful lawyer is just hilarious. But then they get into this very deep story that involves eventually a shooting and a murder. It's amazing what this story is able to do, to go from silly, goofy sitcom to very deep drama.
Now, is this a movie or a TV show?
This is a 7-episode British TV show. It is a complete story in 7 hours. And I recommend this highly. It's on Amazon Prime. It was released there on April 1st. And boy, oh boy, if you want to study character development and how to tell a story that has just so many surprises, The Outlaws is the right thing to watch. Pam, what have you been watching this month?
Now, strangely, I also watched something with 7 characters, but I can't recommend it quite as highly. Netflix told me I should check out a movie from 2017 called What Happened to Monday, and it was pretty interesting. I found it compelling and yet kind of crazy. So it's about a future world where you have a one-child policy, basically, for the entire world, considering problems of overpopulation and climate. But you follow these 7 identical...
septuplets?
I'm not sure if they're septuplets. Well, I mean, I think they were created in a lab. Right. And they're named Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then together, 7 people make up one identity in the world. So 6 of them are always in hiding while one of them's out there. And Monday makes a very dangerous decision. So it's a really weird concept, but kind of compelling. So I don't know. I neither recommend nor disrecommend it. I watched the entire thing.
Glenn Close and Willem Dafoe are featured in there.
Yeah, the acting is very good.
Okay.
The storytelling is a bit odd. So
that's not a strong recommendation, but I'm still intrigued by this. We talked about this back in 2017 when it came out on Netflix, and I am still intrigued by possibility of these seven people living only one life because they're only allowed to be one person and going out one day at a time. No, that's a different sitcom. Let's see what's opening this week. Maybe there's some better stories coming out this week. What do you think, Chip?
Yeah, let's just go to them.
The first one is called Memory. This is the latest Liam Neeson, I will find you and kill you movie.
Well, he has a certain set of skills, Steve. And if he's not being a lion, he's being a Jedi.
Here's my theory. My theory is that Liam Neeson movies have been one word at a time for a couple of, 10 years now. And what they're doing is spelling out a sentence of some sort. And we won't know what the sentence is until after his career has ended. But it's got the word memory in it.
It'll be, I have a certain set of skills. And I have a voice.
Commuter. There is a French film coming out, so we have Pam here to tell us the title of our French film.
Anaïs in Love.
There you go.
Oh, in love. Oui, oui.
there's the French that Chip knows. This is the story of a 30-year-old woman who is going through life, is a coming-of-age kind of film and finding her way in the world. It's an intriguing story for me. There's one called The Sound of Violet. This is a man desperate to find a wife. He finds somebody, a perfect soulmate, but autism keeps him from realizing she's actually a prostitute. There's your twist in The Sound of Violet.
Based on the award-winning novel. There you go, Steve.
Probably a good story. There's one called Firebird. This is a handsome, soulful young soldier who embarks on a clandestine sexual affair with a charismatic fighter pilot on a Soviet Air Force base at the height of 1970s communist rule. Boy, that is not what I was expecting out of the title Firebird. I was expecting Tom Selleck, I think.
Go to the next one, Steve.
All right. Here is... Oh boy, we've had a lot of these the last month. The next one is called Fortress Sniper's Eye, a top secret resort for retired U.S. intelligence officers, and one of them is Bruce Willis.
So you know it's going to be good, Steve.
Bruce Willis, now that he has his diagnosis, I look at Bruce Willis's acting and think, oh, that poor man and his inability to use words. Oh, Bruce.
We've got a horror film, Steve.
Yep, there's one called Hatching that's coming out this week. A young gymnast who tries desperately to please her demanding mother discovers a strange egg. This is not Pod People. This is not Trumpy, but it is the horror movie version of Pod People.
I don't think this is Oscar-winning week, Steve. Let's go to our final film.
Our last one on our Oscar-winning list is Green Ghost and the Masters of the Stone. I can't believe that title exists. This is a Texas border town. A car salesman moonlights as a masked lucha libre wrestler called the Green Ghost. I will watch the heck out of this, especially because it features Danny Trejo, who is just wonderful.
Wow, that's quite a collection of films, yeah. You guys.
It is not a week for movie going, for sure. Spring is here and people are not going to the movie theater. Here's your evidence.
Book it.
Brings us to our book and our book of the week. It is Chip's month to bring a book to the book club. Chip, you have brought us The House of Suns. This was published in 2007 by Alistair Reynolds.
So may I just say that Alistair Reynolds is one of these really prolific sci-fi writers that I've always meant to read. So he's just been on my long list for years and years, and I've never read a single book by him. So when Chip brought this to me, I was like, oh, good. I'm finally going to read a book by Alistair Reynolds. And I loved it. So thanks, Chip.
I am so glad you did. Because when I was reading it, this was not my favorite. So I think I've determined this is not my genre.
Okay, so what is it about this particular writing that you didn't enjoy, Chip?
The maladies, the build-up. One of the things that I did enjoy about it was just they had great big ideas.
Mm-hmm.
The big setup was just big ideas, like being so big and things that were, are they human? Are they robots? Are they trying to figure out and what's going on in negotiations, Steve and Naboo? You never know, Steve. There could be trade stuff going on. This was certainly very science fiction-y.
But it is that brand of science fiction that we have talked about before, very much like Dune, very much like those, as you mentioned, the prequel Star Wars movies, where there's a lot of meetings. And Pam, I know you love books about meetings.
So, is that who I am? A bureaucratic science fiction reader? You might be right. In real world, as in fiction.
So, Pam, you enjoyed this.
I really did. I guess, like Chip, I liked the scope of it. Now, I think it's really challenging as a writer to write something that's 6 million years in the future.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we think in the future within our own lifespans, you think of something that could happen in 2040, maybe 2050. Whoa, like imagine 2070. We can still picture that really easily. But 6 million years in the future, you're really, really asking readers to conceptualize something far, far bigger than themselves. And so, I mean, the concept, which just like Chip, it took me a little while to really understand what was happening at the beginning of this novel. But the idea that you have these 100 shatterlings, these basically clones of each other, who travel around the universe in their giant spaceships, and they have a reunion every 200,000 years. It's just awesome. And when our friends that we're following, they're 55 years late for their reunion. And normally, like, there's always people 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years late. But 55, they should have sent a message. And so, like, that's such a funny detail, but it makes you realize how small our own thinking is. And it's why we're struggling with the climate crisis. We never think beyond our own lifespans. And this is the kind of book that forces you to have a bigger perspective, which I loved.
And I think that was the point of all of the time that is written into this book. You are in the middle of a chase at the end where there are ships chasing each other, and they're talking about it in terms of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years that this chase will take. But the pace of the part that we are seeing is like moment by moment chase happening, and we have to make this adjustment to change the trajectory of this chase in space. But the scope is enormous.
There was a negotiation going on for some parts or something like that, and I can't remember, was it 6,000 years the guy had to wait to mm-hmm. get the negotiation? I mean, that's beyond what humans can really conceptualize.
Or is it? I mean, in some ways, like science fiction, like philosophy, asks us to push how much we can conceptualize, what we can conceptualize. And I find it interesting because, of course, there are lots of different speculative genres that look at basically immortal characters, right? Like these guys have been alive, all of them have been alive for 6 million years. And so sometimes you get the perspective of your immortal characters, basically immortal, get super angsty. And sometimes they just love life. And I don't know, like, it's kind of fun to think about, like, which would you be? Would you be like, I just am so interested in new things that I could live forever and have a blast? Or would you be like, that would be exhausting and I would want to die at a certain point?
And that is not built into this storyline. There is no built-in death for these people. They are immortal. And when we hear that the 1,000 shatterlings have been dwindled down to about 100, there's that moment where we go, okay, so they did die. There was the possibility of death, and we then mourn these clones that didn't make it, but at the same time, that might be sweet release for those people that are going through this eternal life. I don't know which one I would be.
Well, and I liked reading this right after our We Are Legion, We Are Bob read, because I feel like that has that same optimism that if you're interested, if you're a curious and creative person, you would love to live forever, right? And so I kind of liked that.
I was thinking about the Babaverse the whole time, because these are clones, and they are, you know, in bodies, they are human bodies that are going through this adventure. And the whole time I was thinking, but what if they were just computer bits and this was a computer traveling through this time? It would make so much more sense and it would be so much funnier. Remember the Babaverse?
Yeah, you know, this book was kind of short on comedic moments.
Was it? You mean going into was it the robot's mouth and exiting the digestive system?
That was humorous.
You have entered the computer. You have access to everything.
So can I go to the part that you really didn't love, Chip? So the way that this novel is set up, this very large, long novel, it's in
eight
books. And each of the eight books begins with a prologue that is Abigail, the original of these 1,000 Shatterling clones. And Abigail is playing a game, right? And it's a very... It sounds like a terrific virtual reality game that draws you in, kind of like a Ready Player One Oasis kind of game. Like, what do you guys think is the relationship between the My Lady fantasy virtual reality game and then this giant adventure in a 6 million year scope?
I think that the author was trying to draw those parallels between this game and reality, and the flashbacks to all of this in the middle of an adventure. We're in the middle of an adventure, finally, in the third piece of this. Oh my goodness, it's just two-thirds of prologue. But then we get flashbacks back into this game, and I'm like, what is happening? Who cares about this ghost? Oh, by the way, this book has everything: ghosts, vampires. I'm sure that there's a werewolf somewhere in here. They have so many concepts written into this thing. I thought the flashbacks just totally derailed any adventure that was happening.
I'm going to agree with you, because that's where I kept getting lost. I kept going, okay, where am I? Why am I going through this? Oh, let's go back to some negotiations. Okay. Now, yeah. And it kept going. And I kept getting lost where I was.
So did you ever consider that the main narration with Campion and Purslane was the game? I mean,
no, I did not consider that.
Oh, because I think that's a very legitimate reading of this whole novel.
Okay.
Is that this 6 million years ahead is all in the game. And so, I mean, I think I actually read it both ways at once, which is why I found it so cognitively pleasurable.
Okay.
This is why we have a person who reads a lot.
We all read a lot.
To help us out.
I read garbage and she reads good stuff. And so when we get to a book like this, I think, this is boring. And she thinks, oh, this is really, really well done. Go on.
No, but what do you guys think of that reading? Because I think that you could legitimately read. And I thought to myself, ooh, I'm going to now read more of this guy I've been meaning to read forever, Alistair Reynolds. I'm going to read more and I will reread this book at some point with that idea, because it struck me about halfway through the novel. Wait a minute. What if Purslane and Campion are in the game and all of this is just happening in the 31st century? And this is all Abigail's, all her clones, all her avatars having adventures against Mordok the machine people. So, I mean, I think that that's a legitimate reading, but enjoyed.
I think that's headcanon. I think that's you adding something to the text. I don't think that that's in the text unless I completely missed it.
Why does he go to this? Like, he reminds us that Abigail gets super drawn into a game and Mordok gets 100% lost in that game. So I don't know why he would remind us of that 8 times of each novel if he didn't at least want us to consider the possibility.
It is not spelled out for me. Maybe that is the theme that he's going for. I was finding themes in the concepts of time and life and other magazines. No, sorry. and who we are as people. What really started to get to me, I'll rephrase that. What I really finally understood in the theme was how each subsequent chapter was narrated in first person by our two narrators, and finally understanding the idea of personal identity. I got that eventually, but it took me a long time in this long book.
I just said, oh wow.
This is, it's always so much fun to talk about books with you guys.
Mine was the grandness, and certainly one of the questions I always kind of ponder is how long is a day? Well, in the world, the Earth is 24 hours, and another planet could be something else. And then when you get to beings that are so different or large or whatever, there's talking in thousands of years. And it just, the thought process just changes. And that's where I was kind of getting lost. This is we were dealing with, I kept trying to figure out what are we going for here? What was the purpose of this? And anyway, I kept getting lost.
And I would argue that the purpose of speculative fiction is always to play out anxieties that we have in the real world, right? And so whether it's just like a very straightforward space opera or whether it's a really deep award-winning science fiction novel, it's always that same thing. And it feels to me like here, he's really looking at 3 big issues. He's looking at cloning, which is a major, this is a major anxiety in the 90s, right? What if we start cloning people? What would that mean? What would that look like? We've got obviously artificial intelligence anxieties, which are gigantic. And then also data. And so data, memory, like even the idea that in this world, currency is data, right? They don't have anything called money. They exchange information. And so what happens when we have so much information, we can't hold it in our minds, we have to hold it in other technological ways. And so I feel like, it's a big book, big scope, big topics, big issues.
Yeah, that's so 2007, the idea of memory and how much storage capacity we have, how much can we remember? When we're talking about millions of years, can a human brain hold all of those memories? Is there a limit? Do you start to forget things from 2 million years ago?
Well, and that's where the storage would come in. And I think one of the trades was, if I remember correctly, was you'll go in and goes, well, we mined your data and we can use this part of it. This was important to us.
How 2007 is that? The idea of your data and your memory and your capacity is vital to this system that we have built with the internet and the World Wide Web. How do you know what you know? My students frequently don't actually have knowledge. They only have the ability to search and find knowledge. Is that the same as having knowledge? These are big questions in this book.
Well, that certainly would be an interesting question, because you don't have to keep everything in your brain anymore. You need to have access to it. But what if the access is being restricted? Mm-hmm. And there certainly would be a paranoid, part of today's society.
What if the knowledge that's being presented to you is inaccurate? What if the knowledge is propaganda? What do you actually know versus what you're being told?
I mean, Campion and Parslane have both hidden things even from themselves, right? Which we know about Campion really, really early on. We don't realize that Parslane has done the same thing until much later. But this notion that Campion has chosen to actually leave off part of his memory strand. And so all of the Shatterlings are just astonished that he would do such a thing to actually corrupt their 6 million year history. So that question of memory, it's also cultural memory, right? It's also the construction of history and how that can be changed or altered or forgotten. What are the things that we have chosen not to look at in our own history? And I find it really fascinating that there are several types of genocide that happened in this 6 million years of forward history that we examine. And the genocide of the artificial intelligences is a really fascinating idea, right?
That concept of what is life, and the fact that there are these evil robots, this robot race, this mechanical race, not, you know, up against this constructed cloned race, and what is it to be alive? My favorite quote that I wrote down was, "We value life, even the tawdry approximation of life that is the organic." This is the evil robot saying that, that you are alive, I guess, you organic meat people with your meat brain that's so very limited. I guess you're alive.
Yeah, I really love that too. I know, Steve, one of your favorite words is perspective. And this novel definitely plays with perspective between the two different clones, so Parslane and Campion, who are very, very different from one another. And then obviously our robots give us some awesome perspectives. Now, one of my favorite quotes was actually about Data. I thought there were a lot of really quotable passages in this novel, but early on, we're thinking about when Campion has actually released some of his data. Someone says, "All data is stale. The photons reaching your eyes are stale. They tell you that you are looking at something real, but you have no information that the objects before you still exist. They may have vanished into oblivion the instant those photons took wing." And so this is kind of the opposite of the giant scope. This is the super tiny scope. Like, what if the thing that you're looking at right now, we're looking at each other, right, through this moment. What about that tiny delay in perceptual sensory information and data processing?
You didn't tell me I didn't bring the hookah out. Hey, this is a Keanu Reeves moment. Whoa.
This is not a Keanu Reeves moment.
There is philosophy in this writing.
There's a lot of philosophy in this writing.
Big questions about all of these big ideas. Pam, you may not have listened to the show last week, but I brought out a Zen Buddhist book last week and just talked at Chip about Zen Buddhism for 20 minutes. And
I will have to go back and listen to that. Thank you for the reminder. I love it.
The idea of life, the idea of knowledge, where does this knowledge come from? And the idea of staying in the present, back to my Zen Buddhism from last week, everything is the past except for this moment right now. And by the time I say that sentence, this moment now, it's already passed.
Right.
This is good philosophy here.
All we are is dust in the wind.
What if God was one of us? Isn't it ironic?
Or unfortunate. I mean, either way.
Take on me, friends. Take on me.
Exactly. Hit that high note.
All right. Now, getting back to this wonderful book, House of Suns. Now, I think one of the things that made it so great, but you guys may disagree with, is the genre hybridization. So it's obviously a science fiction novel, but it's also a mystery novel. right?
And there's so much fantasy wrapped in it too. There's magic, there's wizards, there's ghosts, there's vampires. There's so many genres in here.
Well, I caught the mystery, and I did catch the fantasy elements too. So, my goodness. Yes, it's got everything.
But I think the structuring of science fiction around a mystery is a pretty common thing that we see. And I think he does a really nice job of it. I mean, I really loved, even super early on when we meet Hesperus, this great machine person, and he has this one arm that's bigger than the other. And when they look inside, he actually has, like, it looks like a human arm. So he's obviously been trying to impersonate a human, which we know is bad, right? Once the machines start impersonating the humans, it's not good. It's Battlestar Galactica time, friend.
Yeah, the Cylons have a plan. Yeah.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, at least they tell us they do.
But Hesperus reveals this, which is like, is it a double game? You know, and I think throughout the entire novel, all 18 hours of this book, I liked Hesperus and I really wanted him to be on the side of the Shatterlings, but I was never sure that he was. So I really thought that Reynolds did a terrific job really leaving it open what people's affiliations were. The characters was very unclear. Now, I felt like he also brought up a really interesting philosophical question in terms of Campion and Parslane. Like, who is your great love in a world where the only people you can really relate to, the only people who live 6 million years like you, are clones of you?
Mm-hmm.
And so
it's a great concept.
Right.
Yeah. Certainly sounds like a problem.
Mm-hmm.
What I don't admire is how much he didn't delve into that. Like, I didn't, like, I read that in the description of this book that these were two clones that fell in love with each other. And I know that it's in there, but it's not really deeply analyzed, in my opinion.
Oh, you didn't think so? Like, what about when Bettany was like, you guys have broken the first rule of Shatterlings, which is falling in love with each other. And then they actually get censured for doing so. I mean, this is one of the reasons that Parslane loses her ship. It's a censure of the other Shatterlings for having this, you know, millions of years long relationship. And actually the censure is not only for having it, but for having it openly. So I kind of got the feeling that, like, other clones have also gone here, obviously, but it's the being open about it. And so it kind of ushers in this new sense of how we're going to construct relationships, which again may well speak to LGBTQ plus issues of our current day.
In 2007.
Part. Yeah. That's interesting. That, no, I thought it was really developed. You didn't think so?
I really didn't. I may have missed it because, again, this is a very long book with so many concepts in it that fell to the wayside for me.
And I feel like the big discussion of it was in a very bureaucratic meeting that was...
I may have missed that meeting.
And it was, oh my gosh. When I read a book like this, I realize how much of my own week is spent in these very bureaucratic Robert's Rules oriented meetings where, you know, people make these determinations and votes and censures and try and see if you have enough votes and all of that. So, yeah.
Suffice it to say, as the person who puts on the musical for middle school, I don't go to a lot of those meetings.
And we're both probably exactly where we're meant to be, my friend.
Got that right. So let's get to optimism, because there's quite a bit of optimism in this future-looking, very, very future-looking story.
Well, there is. And I actually think that part of the fascinating part about the mystery when we're trying to figure out, like, we had this genocide of the Shatterlings, right? Of the Genthian line. There used to be 1,000. There's this enormous explosion. Now there are only 52. And so everyone realizes that there must be one of the Genthians must be in on it. And one of them says, quote, could you kill me knowing everything you do about my experiences? Could you actually be a traitor when you're clones of each other, right? It's a very interesting philosophical question. And then as they discuss this, they realize that whether they have a traitor in their midst or not, there's really only one way to live 6 million years. And I think this is Parslane who says, sometimes you just have to hold on, to keep doing what you're doing, to have faith that things are going to get better. It's how we survive. There have been a million bottlenecks in history where things would have turned out much worse if we'd all just given up and accepted the inevitable. Some of these bottlenecks would have ended us if a few irrational, doggedly optimistic souls hadn't clung to a thread of hope. I love that idea. And again, you guys know I always bring things back to the current day, but like in the face of the climate crisis, sometimes people do feel like, what are we going to do? What are we supposed to do? You keep throwing numbers at me. You're just, my anxiety is through the roof. Students sometimes tell me this, why do I have to take an environmental literacy class? It just makes me sad about the future. And this idea, like we have to imbue our thinking about the climate crisis with optimism. There are bottlenecks in history and you have to believe that we can get through them. That's how we get through them. The sort of psychological research on optimism, it's the best way to approach life, the end.
And we've said that this book was very much like Dune in its scope and all of these meetings and all of the grandness of all of this. But this is the part where it's very much like Doctor Who. There's yeah. so many moments in this book that I think of the Doctor Who style of writing, where the optimism, this one character sees humanity everywhere, and they are always, always happy to find out that humanity survives and how we move on through what seems to be inevitable and doom filled is that optimism, finding a way, getting that right combination to make it.
Well, and Steve, you won't be surprised to know that Alastair Reynolds wrote a Doctor Who novel, Harvest of Time, in 2013. You can feel that idea.
Whoa.
Absolutely, in this world.
There is no doubt that throughout this, I was thinking of Alistair as a Doctor Who fan, somebody who grew up in Britain, in specifically, he was born in Wales, and grew up throughout the whole of Britain. And I know that he was watching Doctor Who as a child because I see that influence, especially in that optimism piece.
That's an interesting something to bring up, because it would show that, or at least demonstrate, the possibility of what your child is exposed to early in life gives them that opportunity to think bigger.
Especially in middle school, when you're in that golden era between age 10 and age 12, the things that you experience become the things that you either absolutely hate because of a bad experience or absolutely love because of a wonderful experience. I think about that every day, standing in front of my middle school students. The words that I say are going to influence them for the rest of their lives. I better be very careful with what I say every time.
I love that. And you're right, like middle school is, I mean, you know, I always feel sort of that way in a college classroom, but I think you're absolutely right. It's even more important and even more crucial to people's development at the middle school level. Now, I'm fascinated, Steve, that you bring up Dune. I actually recently reread Dune for another book club, and it had been like 30 years. And in some ways, this book makes the scope of Dune look small.
Mm-hmm. the time scale in this one is
less spicy. Enormous.
Thank you. But this is one of the most enormous scope books that I've ever read.
And how interesting is it that last month we read The Bobiverse, which has a large scale, but it's nothing compared to this one. That's again, funny. If these people, quote unquote, people are clones, they have biological needs in this time frame that really started to get into my head. Like, how do they survive? How do they eat? Where is all the biological piece of this? If these were just constructs in a computer, if these were just players in a game, like you speculate maybe we're talking about, that solves a lot of that biological part.
Yes, it does.
So Bobiverse. I think Bobiverse is a better book than this.
Well, I enjoyed both in really, really different ways. But I enjoyed both of these books. I think they read nicely together.
Well, I feel much better about this book now that we've had a conversation about it. Because at the beginning, I just kept getting lost in the... It took me multiple attempts to eventually get through Lord of the Rings. And this was very similar. I kept getting lost in what was going on.
And I think that might be on purpose. I think the author wanted you to feel that sense of loss and figure out who you are. Again, that first person perspective where two different narrators start their chapter with I, it certainly... off-putting is not the right word. It is certainly confusing to me. And I think that the author was trying to bring about that philosophical idea of who are you? What are you doing?
Well, and maybe it's stating as a reader that, you know, you really have to dedicate time to getting through this. And
especially the first two thirds.
You can, when I say passively, that's not proper word. You have to really kind of sit down and study.
Mm-hmm. And Chip, I love that you compare this to Lord of the Rings. I would make the comparison in a different way than you did, but I hadn't thought of this. So Lord of the Rings is obviously a classic tale of fantasy. And what's very fascinating about that novel is that the quest, which is articulated right from page one, is not to find an object, but rather to destroy an object, right? The whole quest is to destroy the ring. And oh my gosh, this is great insight that here in this novel, House of Suns, similarly, the whole quest is to destroy the key, right?
My precious.
Indeed. And that brings us back to Zen Buddhism in a way. It's the idea of letting go rather than acquiring. And so it's a kind of,
whoa.
It's a nice connection to Lord of the Rings that I would have never made. This is why I love it.
And my final point on this is we haven't mentioned House of Suns in this conversation of this book, House of Suns. The idea that there is one more house, one more group of these shatterlings, these clones that are the rulers of the whole system. Boy, that is like lost in the whole, there's so many things, there's so many concepts in here.
And that's the other thing that makes me think you can read it as a game, right? And the game is called The House of Suns. People, you know, the game player that you never meet.
Wow. I would say that I would reread this with that perspective, but I'm not going to, Pam.
You know what? I will reread this, but I'll read some other Reynolds books first. I will reread this, though. This was fun.
All right. So, Chip, thank you for bringing us House of Suns. From 2007, a very big, very thought-provoking kind of story.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. What's happening in the world, Chip?
Netflix. Netflix messed their numbers, Steve.
Yes.
And they're actually, there's rumors out there that they could potentially be a takeover target. So if you were a service out there and you were looking to, get a large body of work, Netflix could be a takeover target.
I agree with that analysis because I think Netflix has been on the top of the heap for a long time. And boy, they really suffered from these numbers this week.
And all you could think of is that, you know, we're theoretically, I mean, I'm in Florida. COVID never existed here, but we're at the end of the COVID pandemic. People are going back to their regular lives, having these series, have these things available to you. Certainly, you don't have the time to kind of throw it on in the background as noise or things of that nature. So what is Netflix going to do? They're going to crack down on sharing your password, and they potentially could be a takeover target for some group that wants to have that type of a body of work and wants to have it available. I don't know. Maybe they have a better way of presenting it.
So it's time to take your TV show off of Netflix and make your own app and call it the Gizmoplex, right?
Good. Possibly.
The other thing that's happening in the world is that damn podcast, Indie Podcast Bracket Challenge, which continues this week. 64 independent podcasts came together in a bracket, and we're down to the Sweet 16 this week, Chip. And guess which show, which of your favorite podcasts is in the Sweet 16?
Oh, would that be us, Steve? Did we make it?
Yes, we have. We have made it two levels into the bracket, from 64 down to 32 and down to 16 this week. It was a hard-fought battle. We had some extensive voting this week to push too much scrolling through to the next level. So we want to thank our competitor in last week's competition, Drunk Theory. Go to Drunk Theory and find out all about all the conspiracy theories that are out there. And we welcome our new challenger, Seismic Cinema, that we are going up against this week, and see who gets it into the winner's circle in the Indie Podcast Bracket Challenge. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
What do you think, Pam?
Only if we can come back in 6 million years.
Oh, boy. This podcast is going on for a long, long time. We would love to hear from you. Have you read this book? Are you interested in history of 6 million years from now? Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. Our email is toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and YouTube. And you can always ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hassenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
We'll see you 6 million years in the future. Don't you love Lucha Libre wrestlers, though? I love that. That's just gold for me. Pam, Pam's holding her face. Pam's like, oh, God. Oh, why am I doing this every month with these morons?
No. I usually get some ideas from you guys, but I actually didn't write a lot down on that one. But thanks.